obituaries for today, Monday, November 8th, 2021. Victor Philip, or Phil Meek, went to be with the Lord on November 2nd, 2021. Phil was born in Des Moines and resided there for most of his adult life. After attending North High School, he entered the United States Marine Corps in 1946, serving in Guam and Hawaii. After returning home, he attended Tech Vocab to become a skilled laborer. He worked at Solar Aircraft, and after its closure, John Deere hired him to work in the Research and Development Department until his retirement in 1986. After work hours, he began his own business, siding, roofing, remodeling, and building additions to homes. In 1948, he married his sweetheart, Teresa McGreen, and brought six children into the world. After Teresa passed away, he married Patricia Johns in 1998 and spent his retirement years in St. Augustine, Florida. Victor attended First Baptist Church of Jacksonville. Two of his earthly loves were watching the Jacksonville Jaguars and playing rook, often hiding the rook. He's survived by his five children, Phyllis and spouse Dan Stoll of Palm Coast, Florida, Terry and spouse Leslie Meek of Hopkinsville, Kentucky, Philip and spouse Diane Meek of Florence, Kentucky, Tom, spouse Linda Meek of Johnston, Iowa, Michael Meek of Pontevedra, Florida, two brothers, Jerry and spouse Alice Meek, and Robert D., spouse Jan Meek, both of Des Moines, and finally, two stepchildren, Alicia and spouse Jimmy Rhodes and Billy Johns of Augusta, Florida, or Georgia. He has numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren from both unions. He was preceded in death by his parents, Victor and Agnes Meek, his first wife, Teresa Meek, his brother, Howard Meek, a son, Raymond Victor Meek, and stepson, Johnny Lewis Johns. A viewing will be held at Craig's Funeral Home in St. Augustine, Florida on Friday, November 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. Final services are tentatively scheduled for the 10th of November with visitation at 10 o'clock a.m. followed by services at noon at Hamilton's Funeral Home near Highland Park Memory Gardens, 121 Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. He'll be interred at Glendale Cemetery with military honors. Dr. Neil Harrell. Neil Harrell, a JD-8 of Ames, passed away Thursday, November 4th at Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. Visitation will be from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Friday, November 12th at Adams Funeral Home, 502 Douglas in Ames. A funeral service will be held at noon on Saturday, November 13th, at the First United Methodist Church, 516 Kellogg in Ames. Burial will be the Iowa State University Cemetery in Ames. Neil Harrell was born on October 9th, 1933, in a farm home in Appanoose County, built astride the Mormon Trail. He attended a one-room country school through eighth grade, where he was the only child in his class. When first starting school, he accepted a wager from his father, a tenant farmer, to give him a ewe lamb if he could pass both primary and first grade in 1 year. He did, and he always credited his father for giving him a strong push just at the right time. He eventually graduated valedictorian of a class of 108 rural eighth graders across his county in 1947. Dr. Harrell attended high school in Seymour, Iowa, where he was senior class president and valedictorian of his class of 45. The class salutatorian was a young woman who would later become his wife. Under prodding from one of his high school teachers, Harrell applied for one of the three Iowa Centennial Memorial Scholarships, offered for the first time in 1951, which he would later admit was largely responsible for enrolling at then-named Iowa State College. Harrell and Darlene Harris were married in 1952. They became parents of two sons, James Brent of Denver, Colorado, and Robert Scott of Bedford, New Hampshire, both in 1957 and born in 1957 and 1971, respectively. Dr. Harl graduated from Iowa State in 1955, having served as cadet colonel of the Army ROTC unit his senior year. After a brief stint with Iowa State College Extension, he entered active duty as an artillery officer in August 1955 at Fort Bliss, Texas. Harl ranked second in his officer basic class, which was comprised of equal numbers of West Point graduates and ROTC alumni. He was assigned to the Chicago Gary Missile Defense from 1956 to 1957, for which he received the Commendation Ribbon with Medal Pendant and was promoted to First Lieutenant. From 1957 through September 1958, Harl was a field editor for Wallace's Farmer magazine until his acceptance at the University of Iowa College of Law in 1958. Dr. Harl graduated in the top three of his law school class of 1961. He continued his education at Iowa State University, graduating 1965 with a Ph.D. in economics. Dr. Harl joined the faculty at Iowa State as an associate professor in economics, advancing to full professor in 1967. In 1976, he was named a Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor, one of the youngest to have been recognized. As a faculty member, Dr. Harl published 29 books, gave more than 3,400 presentations across 43 states and 17 foreign countries, served as founding president of the American Agricultural Law Association and president of the American Agricultural Economics Association. Dr. Harl was also appointed to seven federal commissions, including service on the advisory board of the Office of Technology Assessment, where he served as chairman in 1993 to 94. He was deeply involved in efforts to deal with the farm debt crisis of the 1980s, publishing a book about that period in 1990. He headed the group resisting the sale of the Iowa State University-owned television station WOI-TV from 1992 through 1994, also in publishing a book about that effort. From 1990 to 2004, Dr. Harl served as founder and head of the Center for International Agricultural Finance, which has been credited with providing needed economic and legal guidance to 33 countries formerly under control of the Soviet Union, conducting 79 programs at home and abroad for the country's business and governmental leaders to guide their transition to a market economy. Dr. Harl formally shifted to professor emeritus status beginning in 2005, but continued his publishing, seminar, and consulting activities until 2016. In appreciation of the profound impact Iowa State University had on Dr. Harl's life as a student, he and Darlene wanted to create a gathering place for undergraduates. In 2013, the Neil and Darlene Harl Commons was dedicated as part of Curtis Hall on the ISU campus, thanks in large part to the Harl's financial support. Next to his family, his next love was farming. He and his wife acquired 1,000 acres of land in Appanoose County, including the family tract purchased in 1863, on which he was born, and additional land his father farmed as sharecroppers throughout his youth. As he often said, after family and church, the important parts of his life centered on agriculture, law, and Iowa State University. He was preceded in death by his wife Darlene and brother Richard, who is survived by his two sons, five grandchildren, and two sisters, Marjorie Suter of Ames and Myrna Donald of Waterloo. He and his wife Darlene were longtime members of First United Methodist Church in Ames. In celebrating Dr. Harl's contributions to both Iowa State University and Iowa's broad agricultural community, his family requests donations in lieu of gifts be made to a scholarship fund that Dr. Harl created just before his death, the Dr. Neil Harl Opportunity Award, number 270620. Contributions can be made at www.isuf.org. iowastate.info/Harl or sent to Iowa State University Foundation, 310 Curtis Hall, 513 Farmhouse Lane in Ames, 50011. Noting fund number 270620. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left to Neil's family at www.adamsoderstrom.com. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And we have just one obituary left. It's another long one. It is for someone that you probably know quite well, Neil Edward Smith. Neil Edward Smith was born March 23, 1920, and died on November 2, 2021. In his over 101 years, he lived a remarkable life. He was the third child of James and Margaret Walling Smith, following older siblings Kenneth and Mildred. He grew up on a farm near Packwood, Iowa. He loved nature and the outdoors, and later he would share that love with the people of Iowa. He attended a one-room schoolhouse where he often listened to the older students' lessons, and his penchant for learning took him many places and never stopped. He lived through the Depression and found creative ways to raise income. Beginning as a teenager, he managed farms for nearby farmers, owned a gas station, and offered dances at the Packwood Community Center. He enlisted in the Army after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and was called up on his birthday in 1942. He served in the Army Air Corps as a pilot of the B-24 in the South Pacific. He was shot down twice during his tour of duty and was awarded the Purple Heart, 9 battle stars, and the Air Medal with 4 oak leaf clusters. After the war, he returned to Iowa and married his wife of 70 years, Beatrix Havens, whom he considered to be his partner in all of his life's endeavors. Neil took advantage of the GI Bill. He attended the University of Missouri for 1 year before transferring to Syracuse University in New York. Neil, B, and son Doug returned to Iowa, where B and Neil attended Drake University Law School, both graduating in 1950. In keeping with his belief in women's rights, Neil and Bea went into law practice together. However, Neil's interest in politics soon became his primary focus. He was elected national president of the Young Democratic Clubs of America in 1953. In 1958, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Iowa and served there for 36 years. During his tenure in Congress, he served on many committees, including government operations, education and labor, and appropriations. He chaired the Select Committee on Small Business, the Appropriations Subcommittee on Justice, Commerce, and State, and the Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services. He authored the Anti-Nepotism Bill, the Wholesome Meat Act, the Commodity Future Trading Act, the Economic Opportunity Act, as well as co-writing and sponsoring other legislation. His love of nature influenced him to shepherd authorization and appropriations for Red Rock, Sailorville, and Rathbun Dam, so families could enjoy recreation together. In addition, he sponsored creation of what is now the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge and Prairie Learning Center, and trails and green spaces established around central Iowa. He worked closely with both Democratic and Republican members of Congress, Iowa governors, and other Iowa leaders to promote the economic, social, and recreational interests of Iowans. Currently, the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, the Neil Smith Federal Building, the Neil Smith Trail, and the Neil and B. Smith Law Clinic all bear his name. He was often writing, including personal poetry and books, including Mr. Smith Went to Washington, From Eisenhower to Clinton, Hanging Out in Burr Oak, and in 2019, From My Century to Yours, Wisdom from the Near 100-Year Life of former Congressman Neil Edward Smith. Neil was also a family man. He enjoyed attending his son Doug's and daughter Sharon's school events and was a generous and loving grandfather. Although quiet, especially for a politician, he had a sense of humor and enjoyed the company of good friends. He stayed active in many civic organizations up until the pandemic limited his ability to interact with others. He is survived by his son Doug and his wife Janet, daughter Sharon Vandershell and Kevin, 6 grandchildren, Brennan Smith and Katrina, Ryan Smith and Emily Rice, Casey, Elizabeth Daggett Clay and Ethan Vandershell and Aaron Vandershell, 12 great-grandchildren and 1 great-great-grandchild. The family would like to thank Scottish Rite Park for the excellent personal care that Neil received from all the staff while living there. In lieu of flowers, the family would request that contributions be made to the Friends of Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge, Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, or to Iowa Legal Aid, Equal Justice. Private family service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 10th, 2021, followed by burial at Prairie Center Cemetery in Packwood, Iowa. Funeral services will be live streamed, and friends are encouraged to join the family virtually through the link in his obituary at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Jeff?
Thank you, Carol. Two outstanding Iowans, Neil Smith, Neil Harrell, remembered. Let's turn to sports. Lots to report since both major Iowa universities' football teams won over the weekend. We'll start with coverage of Iowa by Chad Leistikow. His article is entitled, Ferentz Quarterback Choice is Obvious but Not Easy. Over 23 years, Iowa football coach Kirk Ferentz has relentlessly stuck by his starting quarterbacks. He's always liked the idea of having that one guy that he can count on from week to week through thick and thin. That's undeniably one of many contributing factors to Ferentz's longevity and consistency at the Hawkeye helm. The instances when he was willing to rotate or juggle quarterbacks are few and far between. The most prominent example are Carl McCann and Brad Banks in 2001, Jake Christensen and Ricky Stanzi in 2008, and Jake Rudock and C.J. Beathard in 2014. In all three instances, the guy that started number two eventually became number one. And there's no question that once they got their chances, Banks, Stanzi, and Beathard elevated the Hawkeye program to euphoric heights. Well, that's not to say that Alex Padilla is the next great Iowa quarterback after one successful relief appearance against a 3-6 Northwestern team. But the redshirt sophomore provided enough juice in Iowa's 17-12 victory Saturday night at Ryan Field that everyone needs to see more, Ferentz included. Padilla's throws were decisive and accurate, and especially when he was turned loose. In a span of 1 3/4 quarters from replacing Spencer Petras at 2:16 of the first to midway through the third, Padilla crisply completed 15 of 23 passes for 161 yards and turned a 0-0 game into a 17-3 Iowa lead. He consistently got the ball to playmakers. For a Hawkeye offense that was desperate for any positive momentum, it was a jolt to the season that was sorely needed. Padilla would go only 3 for 5 for 11 yards in the final 2 minutes, though Charlie Jones dropped a gorgeous fourth-quarter throw that would have converted a 2nd and 13, as Iowa mostly chose, almost to its detriment, to lean on its defense. The late-game play calling was questionable at best. But that's beside the point, which is this. Even though Ferentz was noncommittal about his quarterback situation going forward, he knows what needs to be done. Padilla needs to start next Saturday's 2:30 p.m. home game against Minnesota. Early in Ferentz's 15-minute post-game news conference, he said, hopefully, Petras would be fully healthy by Monday or Tuesday with a shoulder issue that limited his practice time last week. Ferentz also explained that Petras got Saturday's nod, that's his 17th straight start, because his shoulder had improved considerably by Friday. But after three possessions netted 26 yards and one first down against a subpar Northwestern defense, there was a consensus that it was time to turn to Padilla. Padilla, to his credit, has been a diligent backup for nearly two full seasons. Iowa's offensive coaches also deserve credit for having a backup quarterback ready to pinch hit in a key moment. We saw in Iowa's game against Penn State on October 9th, the opponent wasn't ready for that moment, and the Hawkeyes capitalized. You've got to prepare every week like you're the starter. I've been doing that for over the course of the season, said Padilla, who was 5-for-16 for 73 yards in his young career before Saturday. You just have to be ready and waiting for your opportunity. And don't waste that opportunity when it comes around. He didn't. When I asked Ferentz whether Petras would be his starter against Minnesota if 100% healthy, he gave a well-thought-out and respectful answer. We'll look at the film, see what we think. I know this. Spencer's led us to a lot of victories, and tonight Alex did, Ferentz said. To me, that's a good situation. I'm really proud of Alex for what he did. I'm really proud of the things Spencer has done over the past 2 years as well. We'll just take it a day at a time, but hopefully it's, pardon the pun, a healthy situation for us. Hawkeye fans in the pro Padilla camp who are angry at that answer missed the point. Ferentz wasn't dismissing Padilla. Instead, he was showing reverence to Petras, just as Padilla did afterward. Quote, he really rallied around me. He was giving me a whole bunch of tips, Padilla said. Great player, great teammate. I'm with him more than anyone else. Big thanks to him, end quote. Petras has been a leader in the locker room, voted captain every week until this one. Now we know why, considering his health status. He won 12 straight games as a starting quarterback, something only Stanzi and Beathard has done at Iowa in the modern era. This was not the time to turn the page to Padilla publicly, but Ferentz has to know that the right and best decision is to do exactly with Padilla versus Minnesota what he did with Petras versus Northwestern. Start Padilla and have Petras, if healthy, on standby. Additionally, Ferentz needs to give Padilla the majority of number one reps all week in practice. Petras is a tremendous student of the game and could run the offense and game plan against Minnesota in a heartbeat if need be. But just like with Petras on Saturday, Ferentz owes it to Padilla and the team to see what he can do as the guy against the Gophers. He needs to see if the spark the Hawkeyes got Saturday can turn into more. It was no accident that the true freshman Keegan Johnson, who had 5 catches for 68 yards, and Arland Bruce IV, had 3 catches for 30 yards and a 10-yard touchdown run, were Padilla's two favorite and most productive targets on Saturday. The three of them had worked together with the number two unit since spring ball. I think that's one of the main things that played into our success with the passing games today, said Johnson, who despite not being activated fully until week four this season, trails only Sam Laporta in receiving yardage. Me and Arland, when we first got here, we were taking second team reps with Alex. We feel comfortable with Spencer, too, but we knew that if Alex had to step in, we already had that connection down. In other words, Padilla is already lifting up Iowa's future stars. There is little downside to giving him his first career start, particularly because he's the more mobile of the two quarterbacks, operating behind an offensive line that allowed another 7 tackles for loss on Saturday, bringing the season total to a staggering 73. If for some reason Padilla doesn't have it against Minnesota after the first 3 or 4 series, well, it's nice to have someone with experience like Petras as an option off the bench. I admire Spencer for giving it a try. He gave it his best try, said Ferentz, standing by his quarterback, as he always has. We'll see where that is next week. In the meantime, it's great to see Alex get some experience and be successful. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And Randy Peterson's article on the front page of the sports section. ISU's 5-star culture overwhelms Texas. Dateline Ames. Let's not get crazy here. Sure, Iowa State played a wonderful second half during Saturday's 30-7 victory against once proud, once respected, and once good Texas at Jack Trice Stadium. If you want to say its third quarter was great, go right ahead. You're right. It was great. It was 21-zip great against a team that can only imagine how life in the SEC might be. Breece Hall ran with as much authority in the second half as he has during his career. The defense was a concrete wall. But Matt Campbell's team still must win the remainder of its games at Texas Tech, at Oklahoma, and back home against TCU to stay in the Big 12 Conference Championship game conversation a second consecutive year. The Cyclones must go 3-0 the next 3 weeks and hope someone knocks off Baylor again and ditto Oklahoma State. Then, and only then, can fans start thinking about a postseason that includes playing in Jerry World. As well as Iowa State played during the final 30 minutes in which the Longhorns were outscored 27-0, remember, it was just Texas. The Big 12 defectors simply aren't that good. And if spoiled UT fans are not nipping at Steve Sarkisian's backside, I'd be shocked. Saturday was his team's 4th loss in a row. 4th. And yes, Iowa State had a lot to do with that just a week after playing poorly during a loss at West Virginia. So in that respect, Jake Hummel, what's your takeaway after the Cyclones met bowl eligibility on a football perfect night? He said, reassurance, referring his team's bounce back after the 38-31 loss against the Mountaineers. We're still who we think we are. We're as good as we in this building think we are. We can finish out the way we want to. It's that first step of finishing out the season the right way. You have to start somewhere, and on Saturday night, that somewhere was moments after leaving the halftime locker room. Hall capped the first possession with a dazzling 47-yard touchdown run. He caught a pitch from quarterback Brock Purdy, started left, then suddenly cut to the right. He outran Texas defenders into the end zone, and immediately I thought back to what he said after Iowa State's win at the Longhorns last season. 5-star culture versus 5-star players. That's exactly what it was then, and it's what it was Saturday night. Culture trump players. I don't care how you look out. We didn't know it then, but that 47-yard run would be the momentum builder for the rest of the game. Here's what happened after we sprinted into the right corner of the end zone. Texas 3 and out. Iowa State's Corey Dunn dropped a punt at the Longhorns' 4-yard line. Texas 3 and out. Iowa State touchdown. And this one deserves some explanation. Oh, excuse me very much. Sorry about that. Here's what happened after he sprinted into the right corner of the end zone. Texas 3 and out. Iowa State's Corey Dunn dropped a punt at the Longhorns' 4-yard line. Texas 3 and out. Iowa State touchdown. And this one deserves some explanation. The play started when Xavier Hutchinson caught a lateral from Purdy. Hutchinson started running right, then passed long to Tariq Milton, who was at least 10 yards behind the Longhorns' defense. Touchdown, Cyclones. A 49-yarder and 17-7 Iowa State lead. X was a quarterback until his junior year in high school, Campbell said. The pass wasn't pretty. You now know why he's not a quarterback anymore. Offensive coordinator Tom Manning called the play from his seat in the press box. He'd worked on it with his guys for the past few weeks, just waiting for the perfect opportunity. Campbell, who can hear everything his assistants say from his sideline headset, heard Manning call the wide receiver pass. How did the head coach react? I said, run it as fast as we can, Campbell said. We knew they're really aggressive at the corner position. We felt that was going to be a great play. It was the right time. It was perfect timing for the play. Perfect indeed, as was Iowa State for the final two quarters. Texas responded with another three and out. Hall finished a drive with a 2-yard touchdown run, and now it's 24-7 Cyclones. Sarkisian said, we struggled all night offensively to generate anything, and our defense was worn out. It's unfortunate the momentum swung in their favor. We could just not get a first down to change any of the field position or momentum. They were the better team. They controlled the game. They won the game. No one is disputing that. Hall's 136 yards on 19 carries put him over the 1,000-yard mark for the second season in a row. He's got 1,121 heading into next Saturday's 2:30 p.m. game at Texas Tech. And no one is disputing the 119 yards for which Hall rushed during the Cyclones' mighty second half. Campbell said Brees had maybe one of the best games of his career. When Brees and I talk, we talk about a complete tailback. There's been some times it's been good, and there's been times where that's not been to the standard that I think we would want that to be. Purdy was good too, completing 27 of 38 passes for 252 yards, and once again, no one could consistently block defensive end Will McDonald. He became the school's career sack leader early in the game, and he was a constant disruptor all evening. Like his teammates, he was especially good in the Cyclones' game-winning second half. Hummel said, we just all started playing together well. We played on their side of the ball. That kind of play must continue. Iowa State must do its part to keep alive its hope of playing in another Big 12 title game. Or else. Jeff?
Back to the Hawkeyes. This article entitled, Padilla Provides Spark, Iowa's Offense Needed. With 2 minutes 16 seconds left in the first quarter, Iowa could wait no longer. With the offense struggling mightily against Northwestern and Spencer Petras clearly not 100%, Kirk Ferentz did something that he rarely has done in 23 years as a head coach. He gave the keys to a new quarterback. Alex Padilla, a redshirt sophomore who's been Iowa's number two for nearly two full seasons, was thrust into his first significant moments as a Hawkeye in a 0-0 game after the teams traded seven punts. In less than 13 minutes, Padilla provided the spark Iowa's offense desperately needed, leading touchdown drives in his first two possessions at the helm in what would become a 17-12 win under the lights at Ryan Field. Padilla completed 18 of 28 passes for 172 yards in relief of Petras as the 16th-ranked Hawkeyes improved to 7-2 overall and 4-2 in conference play. They're in a four-way tie with Minnesota, Purdue, and Wisconsin for the top of the Big Ten West. Before we get into Padilla's difference-making moments, it's worth pointing out that what led to the change. Number one, Petras took a big shot the week before at Wisconsin. He tried to go Saturday with a bad shoulder and couldn't do much, going 2 for 4 for 4 yards on 3 possessions. He made good progress during the week. We were all confident he'd be able to go today, Ference said. I don't think it's anything major, just something you've got to work through. Hopefully, Monday or Tuesday, he'll be back to full speed. Number two, here were Iowa's numbers on 30 possessions since Petras' terrific 43-yard touchdown pass to Nico Reganey for the winning points versus then number four Penn State on October 19th. 14 points versus 15 punts. Just 27 first downs. A meager 3.31 yards per play on 135 snaps. Four interceptions thrown. Two fumbles lost, one missed field goal, and four turnovers on downs. The numbers and situation were simply too bad to ignore or stomach anymore. So, enter Padilla. It was kind of out of the blue, kind of a surprise to me, said Padilla, who first heard he was going in through the headset he wears as the backup quarterback. No time to think about it. Just had to go out and do what the team needed. The redshirt sophomore from Colorado zipped a 17-yard strike to Keegan Johnson on his second snap, then a 26-yarder to Johnson on his fourth. Six snaps into what looked like the Padilla era at Iowa, Tyler Goodson was romping into the end zone from 13 yards out for a 7-0 Iowa lead. The score was Goodson's first in 94 carries, the longest touchdown drought of his three-year starting career. That goes to show how much of a struggle it's been for Iowa's offense as a whole. And how unprecedented was the change? Ference hadn't voluntarily juggled quarterbacks in meaningful moments since Jake Rudock and C.J. Beathard alternated series in the 2015 Tax Slayer Bowl. I was really pleased and really proud of the way Padilla prepared during the week, Ference said. Did a good job there and certainly thought he did a lot of good things on the field tonight. So, what changed with Padilla in charge? Iowa gained 361 yards, its highest total since October 1st against Maryland. We saw a heavy dose of Johnson, the true freshman. Johnson collected four first-half catches for 61 yards and was the target of a deep shot early in the third quarter that drew a pass interference flag. Johnson is quickly becoming one of Iowa's best playmakers. We saw a lot of zip on the football. Padilla was touted as a more mobile option than Petras, and he is. But Padilla's priority was throwing the football, not using his legs. A bevy of screens and quick balls over the middle were called in the playbook. He hit Goodson for 19 yards on a 3rd-and-7 strike, then Johnson on a tunnel screen for 8. Arlen Bruce IV capped that 9-play, 83-yard drive with a second-effort, 10-yard touchdown run on a jet sweep. That put Iowa in front 14-0. To be able to see Keegan and A.B. as first-year players and produce the way they produce is amazing to see, said Goodson, who lauded both true freshmen for their diligent work in practice. We also saw more targets for Tyrone Tracy Jr., 4 in the first half alone. 2 were caught for 17 yards, finally pushing him over 100 yards receiving for the season. Play-action passes were Padilla's friend. They helped hold back the pass rush that had been crushing Iowa in the previous two games in losses to Purdue and Wisconsin. Prior to Saturday's game, Padilla's career numbers were 5 for 16 for 73 yards, all in mop-up duty. Ference had said during the summer that he trusted Padilla to run the offense, but he never caught Petras, who technically improved to 13-4 as a starter for first string. Noah Shannon got the ball rolling for Iowa's defense with a big first quarter effort. A less discussed story recently has been the lack of pass pressure by Iowa's defensive line. The Hawkeyes entered Saturday with just 2 sacks in their previous 4 games, with only one coming from a defensive lineman, that's Deontay Craig against Penn State. Shannon changed that with a big sack of Andrew Marty on Northwestern's second drive. The defensive tackle blew up a called screen pass, spinning Marty down for a 12-yard loss after the mobile Wildcat quarterback had burned Iowa for 2 first-down runs. On the next series, Chicago-area product Lucas Van Ness knifed through Northwestern's offensive line to deliver a drive-killing sack of his own. With Iowa's offense struggling badly out of the gate, the defensive line offered some help. An argument could be made that the D-line was responsible for keeping this a 0-0 game until Iowa made the quarterback change. Like with the turnovers, it's just little details, things like that, Iowa defensive end Zach Van Valkenburg said. We were able to get there a little more tonight. Then, after Iowa took a 7-0 lead, Dane Belton delivered another much-needed play for the defense. The Hawkeye safety tracked down a deep shot by Marty and hauled the pass in for Iowa's 17th interception of the season, but first since Matt Hankins' pick at the end of the Penn State game. The defense mostly stood strong in the face of adversity. With Iowa's lead at a healthy 14-0 late in the first half, Torrey Taylor had a punt blocked, a shocking development considering how good Iowa's special teams have been. And Northwestern recovered at the Hawkeye 10-yard line. That was the first of two first-and-goal situations that Phil Parker's defense escaped with allowing short Charlie Cubander field goals. Then, with the Wildcats driving midway through the fourth quarter with the help of an awful pass interference call on Hankins on fourth down, Parker, visibly angry by the official's flag on Hankins, brought the blitz from Belton. The pressure was enough for Marty to throw the ball earlier than he wanted to, and Jamari Harris, starting in place of injured Riley Moss and Terry Roberts, collected his first career interception in the end zone for a touchback with 8:02 remaining. It was a great moment for the Chicago native in his hometown and was the 18th interception of Iowa's season. Harris became the 10th different Hawkeye with a pick this season. That interception proved big, considering Evan Hall cut into the Hawkeye lead with a 31-yard touchdown catch with 2:21 remaining. Iowa was disciplined on the failed two-point try, a reverse pass. Belton would clinch the result with his interception of Marty with a minute 44 to go. That was interception number 19 for the Hawkeyes this season. Considering Iowa finished minus 3 in turnovers and back-to-back losses, finishing plus 3 in turnovers in Evanston was just what the Hawkeyes needed. It was quite a relief. I knew we had to make the play. We knew the game was riding on us, Belton said. We did what we were supposed to do. We put out the fire and ended the game. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And now going to the Iowa Life section of the Register is an article entitled, Are You a Worrywart? It's by Mike Ronisvale for the USA Today. It shows people, men and women, and their caricatures that are drawn in, and they're all worrying. And here are some of the things that are going through their minds. What if my child gets sick? What if I get sick? What if I don't do well on the presentation at work? What if I don't pass the test? What if she doesn't accept my invitation to go out on the date? What if we don't get invited to the Christmas party? What if they think I'm too fat? What if they think I'm too skinny? What if the economy tanks? What if, what if, what if? The number of ways we can ask what if is truly astounding. There's virtually an endless supply of situations in life in which we can worry about potential negative outcomes. Many people wake up worrying about bad things that might happen during the day and go to bed worrying about other unsettling things that might happen tomorrow. Although the research indicates that up to 90% of what we worry about never happens, many people continue compulsively playing the what-if game for days and weeks and months and years. Why do we do this to ourselves? Why do we continue to obsess about outcomes that in all likelihood will never even come to pass? The answer to this question is as complicated as it is surprising. There's a behavioral reinforcement for chronic worrying that ensures we continue to engage the worry cycle over and over again. Basically, worrying works. Think about it. If we believe that worrying about something will prevent that bad thing from taking place, and 90% of what we worry about never happens, there is strong reinforcement for continuing to worry. Worriers then develop a very strong belief that worrying is necessary to prevent bad things from happening. Even though there is no truth in the belief that our worry prevents negative outcomes, many worriers turn worrying into a compulsion that is difficult to control. And that's where many of us are when we play the what-if game from sunrise to sunset, desperately trying to make sure bad things don't happen to us or the ones we love. Let me give you an example of how that looks in everyday life. Let's say I have a deep fear that I will look incompetent when I give the big presentation at work, and I compulsively worry about that presentation until it's over. Assuming the presentation goes well and I get positive feedback from my coworkers, I now have proven to myself that the worry worked to prevent the negative outcome. It's a vicious cycle that contains chronic worry and creates a negative pattern that drives the what-if game indefinitely. So, what can we do if we are caught in the pattern of chronic worry, desperately trying to prevent bad things from happening every day? Recognize when worrying about a specific outcome turns into critical self-talk. It doesn't take long for someone who is a chronic worrier to see concern about a negative outcome turn quickly into an opportunity for self-contempt. It's not uncommon for self-critical themes to creep into the stream of thoughts that are facilitating the worry. For instance, many times as we begin to worry about an outcome, we might attach our personal inadequacy as one of the reasons things might go south. Let's go back to the worry about looking incompetent at the presentation for work. While the cognitive stream might start with, what if I don't communicate well and my boss is disappointed? And it might end with, I'm a screw-up and I'll never be a success. Bottom line, feelings of personal inadequacy are an inevitable consequence of worrying, regardless of what we are worried about. Part of defeating the worry cycle is to pay close attention to when you start to hear that negative, critical voice in your head. That's your clue that you have started playing the what-if game, which will allow you to move from beating yourself up to focusing on a positive, constructive problem-solving. Look at the deeper meaning underneath the worry. In order to beat down the power of worry in your life, it is important to understand the deeper longings that are underneath your fears of bad outcomes. Typically, we tend to worry most about the things that are closest to our heart and drive our sense of self. I've never met a person who was deeply worried about health concerns who did not have a strong desire to be alive and healthy. I've never met a socially anxious person who did not, on some level, deeply want to be connected to people. If you are struggling with a significant worry, try to disconnect from the what-if game for just a minute and become an observer of the process you're going through. What does this worry suggest you deeply care about? If you can allow yourself to be more aware of the deep desires that drive your worry, you will be in a much better position to be able to think rationally about how to even get the desired outcomes. Understand that a positive outcome is highly connected to a healthy process. The irony of this entire discussion is about worry is striking. We care deeply about parts of our life and are concerned about our inadequacy and our ability to achieve them. This leads us to believe, on some core level, that a positive outcome is more likely if we worry and obsess about the what-ifs. Unfortunately, our strategy of focusing on negative outcomes has been consistently identified in the research as one of the most compelling reasons people fail. The more we focus on outcomes, the worse we perform in almost every area of our life. It doesn't matter whether it's a sporting event or a romantic relationship. Focusing on the outcome will dramatically decrease our effectiveness. The focus on the healthy process is the one well-researched fact that has consistently been associated with actually creating positive outcomes. A basketball player who focuses on the fundamentals involved in a good jump shot will surely score more points than a basketball player who is overly concerned about whether or not the ball goes in the net. A professional who is concerned about a healthy process when preparing for a presentation at work will most certainly perform better than a professional who spends an inordinate amount of time worrying about how they might screw up the presentation. In order to minimize the power of worry in your life, it is essential that we create positive self-talk where we tell ourselves the truth about the outcomes. We can't get stuck in strong unconscious beliefs that tell us worrying will prevent bad things from happening. We have to focus on the next healthy thing we can do that will indeed produce the most positive outcome possible. This new belief has to play out in our self-talk. Minute by minute, moment by moment, I will make the decision that I will refuse to play the what-if game any longer. The more we practice a belief in the value of process over outcome, the more we will build a new narrative about our ability to avoid the feared result and live out our deepest desires and longings. Coach yourself. At the end of the day, this is going to be a challenging process for all of us. You're not going to finish reading this article and immediately stop playing the what-if game. The most important thing you can do is armor yourself in the battleground of your mind. When you find yourself amid a worry cycle, purposely replace that negative self-talk with a positive and healthy coaching statement that you might hear from a good athletic coach. You've got this. You can't control the outcome, but you can do your best to execute a healthy process. Your best effort is all you've got. That kind of statement helps identify whether or not you're worrying about your performance on the presentation at work, obsessing about whether or not you're going to get sick, or managing the prospect of potential rejection in a relationship. If you find yourself falling into the category of a worrier, get curious about it and put forth the effort to ease your mind and begin to witness the positive outcomes roll in. Remember, there are 4 tools that are helpful if you need to pull yourself out of chronic worrying. Identify when you worry specifically about outcomes and how that results in negative self-talk. Search beyond the worry and find the deeper meaning. Know that a positive outcome is highly correlated to a healthy process, and be your own coach, positively influencing your processes toward all you desire and putting away that what-if game. And this is by Dr. Mike Ronisvell, who is a licensed psychologist and president of Live Well Behavior Health, a psychological service agency that provides counseling to clients of all ages and addictions, treatment to adults and adolescents. You can find him on the web at www.livewellbehavioralhealth.com and www.livewellcoaching.com or call 321-259-1662. Jeff?
Thank you, Carol. It's time for Dear Abby. Man worries about living up to his wife's one-time lover. Dear Abby, my wife and I have been married for 21 mostly happy years. However, last year I had an affair that lasted for several months. I confessed to my wife and we separated for about a month while I tried to evaluate what I should do. In the end, I returned home and asked for forgiveness and reconciliation. Obviously, my wife has struggled with my infidelity, but to her credit, she's trying hard to make things work. During our separation, we had little contact, and she told me that for revenge, she had slept with someone else. I'm struggling with the mental image and thoughts of trying to match his level of stamina. I know I messed up, but I love my wife, and I'm working hard to demonstrate it. How do I purge my thoughts of the image of my wife with another man? Signed, Remorseful in California. Abby responds, Dear Remorseful, it may not be easy. Don't you think your wife has had similar mental images of you and the woman you cheated with? Infidelity hurts everyone involved. You and your wife are working to remain reunited. Concentrate on that rather than preoccupy yourself with your insecurities, and you'll both be better off. The second letter, Dear Abby, my teenage grandson plays on his middle school's football team. He's a great player, but the team never wins. It's hard to watch him play his heart out when the team loses in a 38-0 range. I'm proud of his efforts, and I want to encourage him. Do you have any suggestions? Signed, Proud of Him in the West. Dear Proud of Him, I think what you are already doing is the right approach. By attending these events, you're telling your grandson how proud you are of the fact that he gives his all when he competes. Take him out for a post-game dinner and a treat. Recapping the weather for today, we're going to have mostly sunny and mild. Some clouds near Des Moines. Wind's going to be west-northwest at 4 to 8 miles per hour. Mostly cloudy tonight. Winds light and variable. High today of 63, low tonight 46. Continuing through the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday with highs in the high to low 50s. Friday, it's getting cold. 44 for the high, 43 on Saturday, 42 on Sunday. Looks like November in Iowa. And that concludes the reading of the Des Moines Register for today, the 8th of November, 2021. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone this morning has been Carol Lockard. Earlier, you heard Gordy Allen and Sharon Goldford. You can access IRIS programs on any computer, smartphone, mobile device, or smart speaker like the Amazon Echo or Google Home. If you'd like to learn more, just give us a call, 243-6833, toll free at 1-877-404-4747, or check out our website, iowaradioreading.org. Special thanks to our broadcast partners, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and our music partner, bensound.com. Most of all, thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.